I have Dr. Jesse Lopez from Doc of All Trades here today to talk about a bunch of different topics. One, we talk about his specific investing portfolio strategy. He does a lot of rebalancing and more active involvement in his investments, so it's kind of interesting to hear about that. Two, we talk a bit about cryptocurrency. Don't run away. You'll be okay for those of you that hate it. Three, we talk about his medical mission trips to Honduras and what one of those are actually like. And then four, we get into a really in-depth conversation about negotiating your salary when you are the Tom Brady of your industry. You might remember a few episodes ago, we talked about negotiating when you're the underdog with Financial Mechanic. Well, what do you do when you are super qualified and you are having the upper hand in a salary negotiation? Let's get to it.
Welcome to Fire Drill Podcast, where side hustles, savings, and creativity lead to financial independence. With your hosts, Gwen from Fiery Millennials and Jay from Millennial Boss.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Fire Drill. I'm so excited to have Jesse here from Doc of All Trades. Welcome.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Jesse, please tell the audience a little bit about you.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm an anesthesiologist. I'm 47 years old. I have three kids, one that's launched and two that I'm still working on launching. I've been practicing medicine for about 15 years, and I was one of those kind of go-getter physicians. And starting from my very first job, I hit the ground running. And as a busy anesthesiologist, I worked pretty long hours. And on top of that, I decided to run the department. So early on in my career, I made it a point to volunteer for every single committee that I can get my hands on. And sometimes I would even show up to committees without being invited. I'd say, hey, I'm here. And no one seemed to mind that. And then next thing you know, within a few years, I became the vice chairman of my department. Then I started running the schedule, and next thing you know, I was running the whole department probably 6 to 7 years into my practice. I ran the department for about 5 years or so, and then one day it just became too much. I was working long hours. Well, I was the medical director. Although I got compensated very little, and the job just took over my entire life. I felt like I wasn't spending enough time with my kids. And so one day I encountered a tweet from Physician on Fire. And the tweet basically said, hey, I'm an anesthesiologist. I'm retiring at 43. And I said, wow, that's a thing? I had no idea. And I went to my financial advisor, said, hey, I want to retire. And he said, no problem. I'll get back to you in a week. A week later, he comes to tell me, you get to retire at age 64. We figured it out. Congratulations. And so from that point forward, I decided to fire my financial advisor and kind of figure out this financial independence thing. And I'm not quite there yet, but I'm getting very, very close.
So what's your timeline to get there and what's your plan?
So it all depends on your burn rate. Corey Fawcett is a big hero of mine. He's a physician his website's called Financial Prescription. Basically, he feels like all physicians, and I totally agree with this, all physicians make a lot of money. And depending on how much money they burn will determine whether they get to retire or not to retire. So I always tell my wife, if we move to Costa Rica tomorrow, I could retire like right now. But since we have kids still in school and I want to make sure I have enough money for them to, you know, successfully graduate through college, my current financial plan is about 10 years. If I continue to save for 10 years, that'll get me to 53, and then I could completely retire from medicine forever and pretty much maintain a fat FIRE lifestyle.
Where do you guys live?
We live in Ohio right now.
And how old are your kids?
I have a 10-year-old and 13-year-old and a 24-year-old.
I'm curious to hear what you are planning to do for their education. Are you assuming that you're going to have to pay full ride for them? And are you giving them options that they can go wherever they want, or they have to go to state school and this is how much you set aside? How are you doing that?
You know, that's a tricky question. I know with all the latest news, these parents are paying just tremendous amounts of money to get their kids into the top schools. And I'm of the opinion that having your kid go to a top school does provide them with an advantage, but not necessarily an advantage that's going to change their life. So if they're going into perhaps computer engineering or some high tech job, they would have you want to have a good name behind your background. But if you're going to medical school, you're going to need to go to a state school because, you know, you want to be a big fish in a small pond and not the other way around. And so I know people, friends of mine who graduated from medical school, they went to Ivy League, and they owe upwards of $300,000 in student loans. And unless you're making $500,000 to $750,000, paying that debt back is almost impossible. So I'm okay with the state school right now. I've already saved, I'd say, half the money for my kids. And if I had to, I could ease, you know, let's say they wanted to go to an Ivy League school and it made sense for them because of the degree they chose, then I would send them. Otherwise, if they want to go to a state school, I'm totally okay with that.
And how are you saving the money for them? Are you opening 529s and saving there?
I saved half the money in a 529 and I saved the rest just in a traditional IRA, or actually not even in a post-tax dollar brokerage account. My logic behind that is if the kids do decide that they don't want to go to college, I don't want to basically have dead money. The beautiful thing about having the 529 is that that money will grow interest-free, tax-free, and then I could apply that towards their education. But the problem is if I over-save my money on the 529, then I'll have money that I won't really even be able to use. And the idea is I want to be able to give each kid enough money to launch them without having too much burden of debt when they start their careers.
People say that the 529 is a good idea because you can always use the money for another purpose. Now, the purpose has to be education, I believe. So your niece or your nephew or yourself could use the money, but the amount of money that you would have to save for college, are you really going to use $100,000 on yourself for cooking lessons in Italy, for example?
Exactly. Exactly. So for me, my max is going to be about $100,000. And beyond that, it's kind of crazy to save more money. Now, my thing is, I told my kids this very clearly. I said, my goal is financial independence. I will support you, but at some point, you know, you're going to have to launch by, you're going to have to support yourself. And 10 years is the plan. At some point, they're going to have to help themselves. Because once I stop practicing medicine, I don't want to go back to do it again. And the thing about medicine is once you quit medicine, it's tricky. You can't just go back and restart. In fact, Physician on Fire had just quit. He's quitting in August. And the discussion is once you quit, it's a one-way street. There's coming back would involve re-educating yourself. You may even have to get another mini residency to prove to a credentialing committee that you're still capable of practicing medicine. So it's a one-way street. So once you quit, it's over.
Do you think that market is ripe for disruption, though? So right now, for example, whenever I have a cold or something's wrong with me, I find urgent care to be very convenient. What if there were this network of retired physicians? Like, I don't care if they stopped practicing 5-10 years ago. They can tell me if I have pneumonia or something like that. You know, like maybe there'd be those options in the future, kind of like contract work.
That would be awesome. In fact, that's kind of already happening a little bit right now. So telemedicine is becoming a really huge industry where physicians who no longer want to practice in the traditional brick and mortar are getting on their computers and just answering phone calls from patients. And the way currently it works, let's say you have an insurance company and you are a member of that insurance company, they will then contract with these physicians and then you get to call them for free. And it really, really helps your company because then they don't have to pay for that ER visit or that urgent care visit, which currently is just ridiculously expensive. So that is definitely an option.
How do you feel about walking away from your career? The reason I ask is that people have made the argument that maybe physicians should not be retiring early because we really need them. Like, it doesn't really matter if I retire early because who needs another tech person? But from your perspective, you have a skill set that you can save lives. You have all these things that are very valuable to society. Do you wrestle with that at all? Or you think that's not even an issue?
Oh my God. So there was an article on Doximity just about this exact same thing. And, you know, I'd say about a third of the people felt very, very strongly that we have a social duty and obligation to serve society. Whereas another two thirds felt like, well, it's your life. You can do whatever you want with it. And I started kind of thinking about that intellectually. And here's what I came up with. If you look at the number of hours a physician works, so on average, when you're in medical school, when you're in your training, you end up putting in between 80 to 100 hours a week with no vacation. You know, maybe in medical school, you get a couple weeks off. With traditional school, if you're an undergrad, you get the summers off. Medical school, there's no such thing. You work straight for 4 years. And same thing with your residency, you work straight for anywhere between 3 to 7 years. And typically, you get 2 to 3 weeks of vacation. So by the time you finish your career, you would have put in more hours than a teacher who's put in 25 years in a public school system. And so if you look at just the paying your dues, by the time physicians just finish residency and they're, you know, chock full of debt, they've already put in their hours. Let's say they put in another 10 years, that's above and beyond. So really the solution is here, in my opinion, is you need to make a situation for physicians to lessen the burden so that they don't become burned out. And that what the system has done, at least the current healthcare system, every year since I've been practicing medicine, they add another layer of regulations, another layer of bureaucracy, another layer of compliance requirements that we have to engage in. Otherwise, we can't practice medicine. And so at some point, the physician says, well, it's so time consuming that I have to take away from my family just to maintain my license, much less my credentialing. It's not worth it anymore. And so a lot of millennial physicians, which we got to give them the credit for, as well as all millennials, that they say, hey, I actually want to have a life. I don't want to just give my whole life to medicine.
That definitely makes sense. And no one wants a burnt out physician. That's way worse.
You know, you want to hear a funny story. Just yesterday, I got a phone call. It was a younger physician yelling at me on the other line because I had not attended one of my compliance classes. And I thought it was an online class, so I just kind of blew it off. And then it turns out I actually have to show up for this class. And everybody who took this class, they said it's 2.5 hours. You show up, somebody lectures for you for 2.5 hours on things that are pretty, you know, a lot of common sense, like, you know, make sure you document your medications, make sure you don't violate all the different laws, and make sure you communicate with other physicians, like things that are basic. But the reason why we're forced to do it is because the hospital has to prove to the government that they're keeping in compliance, that they're giving the physicians the proper information. And so then we actually have to sign that we attended it and that we're not going to harm any patients, you know? And so at some point, it kind of gets ridiculous.
I can definitely imagine that. I mean, the more red tape you add to a job, the less you want to be in that job.
Exactly.
So now that you have this idea of financial independence and retiring early, how has your life changed? Like, have you added different hobbies? Have you cut back on work?
When I reached my peak of burnout, I quit everything. I told my group I was no longer interested in being a medical director. I stopped attending meetings. And then I decided after attending a conference called SEEK, S-E-A-K, it's a non-clinical careers conference for physicians. And this conference basically helps physicians find careers outside of medicine. At that meeting, I met some of the most amazing physicians. One in particular was Dr. Michelle Mudge Riley. Her website's called Physicians Helping Physicians. And I saw all these amazing stories of people who basically transitioned out of medicine. So from that point forward, I decided I wanted to cut back on my hours. And I wanted to find a career that I could either supplement my current clinical practice or I can transition out of. And so from that point forward, I went straight to the director's department and I said, I want to go down by 25%. So I wanted to reduce my clinical time to 75% only. And of course, the first thing they told me is no way. And, you know, I spent hours working with other physicians, trying to find a way that was made it revenue neutral. And I put up all the facts and figures. But at the end of the day, they basically told me no. And so then I decided to strategically quit my job. I quit. That was it. And I decided I was going to either do locums, which is basically shift work where I'm helping being an independent practitioner, or I was going to get another job somewhere in the industry. So since then, they renegotiated with me after I walked away. They offered me a 75% job. So I've been working 75% of the time, making 75% of my salary. And now I have my life back so that I could spend my time pursuing these non-clinical pursuits.
So let's talk a little bit about your recent trip to Honduras.
Oh yeah, that was awesome. I met Physician on Fire and a bunch of other physician bloggers at FinCon. And you and I, even we had an awesome conversation and you really inspired me quite a bit. So for that, I thank you. And just having a conversation with Physician on Fire, he's also an anesthesiologist, and he had mentioned to me that he had just come back from a mission in Honduras, and he was looking for people to volunteer to go with him the following year. He told me about it, and I read his blog, and I almost immediately said yes. He took his wife and kids to Honduras, and so I wanted to do the exact same thing. And when we got there, it was nothing like I expected. It was a lot of work, but it was some of the most rewarding work I have ever done. And Honduras with One World Surgery, which is the group I went with, these were the most amazing people. And after 1 week, we're all best friends. We have worked really, really hard. We helped a lot of people. And now I feel like I have another family that I didn't have before. And just really a great way to network with people, a great way to find your purpose and mission in life. And it felt really good to help others who really needed it. and hanging out with Physician on Fire and his family. They're awesome people, and I look forward to hanging out with them again in FinCon.
So for people that are not physicians, whenever I see pictures from a medical mission, I see people in scrubs looking happy, taking pictures. Like, what is it actually like? Do they just bring you right into the operating room and then you are allowed to do whatever you do back in the U.S. there?
You know what's cool about these medical missions is that you don't have to be a physician or a nurse to go to them to attend. What they really want, somebody who just really wants to go there and contribute, be a team player, and help the people. So the first day I showed up at the mission, One World just did a great job. They were very organized. We took a bus from Tegucigalpa in Honduras, and we drove an hour south to Rancho Santa Fe, which is where the surgery center is at. Also on this ranch, there are 300 kids who live there who don't have families, and they're called Nuestro Pequeños Hermanos, NPH. And that's a mission that helps children who basically either lose their parents, or maybe their parents don't have the economic means to take care of them. And then they will take care of that kid from birth all the way to help them finish their education and live and pay for it. So the day I showed up, they took us straight to the surgery center. They gave us a day orientation. They showed us where everything was at. It was a Sunday. And then Monday morning at 5:30 in the morning, we started operating just like that. And, you know, we threw on scrubs. We were all complete strangers. But we're, you know, they did a really decent background check. So you couldn't just be a physician who, you still had to go through the same credentialing process. They needed to vet you out. They needed to make sure that you had a license, that you didn't have any issues with your license. And so all the people that I worked with, the clinicians in particular, were just unbelievably amazing. And it's kind of like practicing in the United States. We do the exact same surgeries, but with like a third of the resources. At one point, one of the surgeons, he's a funny guy, he got out a hammer and a saw, and he started just hammering and grinding away at these at a nail that he was putting inside someone's bone that in the United States, you would just, somebody would manufacture for you. In Honduras, he would just take one that was already there, and he made this person an implant. It was crazy. But there were also non-volunteers. And the non-volunteers, they had an equally awesome time. They were helping prepare food for the volunteers. They were helping clean the kitchen. They were helping improve the facilities. At one point, they built a sidewalk. They were, you know, mixing sand and cement and building stuff. And one of the 13-year-olds, this kid was awesome. He volunteered to clean the pigs. So they had a ranch there with animals. He was out there scrubbing a pig, you know. So it was pretty awesome.
Wow, that definitely paints a picture of what it's like, kind of an everyone pitch in, do whatever it takes to get it done type mentality. Cool.
Yeah, and you know, if anyone ever is interested, they have brigades. Last year they had 29 brigades. This year they're shooting for about 40 brigades. And we went from, I think, 500 surgeries to over 700 surgeries. And all are welcome. And it's an awesome experience.
So are you planning to do more of these when you retire early, or what's your plan?
So currently my plan is I'm writing a post for Physician on Fire about my experience. So if you go to his website, you'll be able to read about, you'll see pictures. I wrote, I think the post is called 9 Reasons to Go to One World Surgery and 1 Reason Not to. And it just talks about all the things that I did and what to expect if you do that. And then going forward, my main goal is to take my family, because Physician on Fire's family, they just love the experience. And it's just, it's an education that you can't get in the United States. It opens your eyes to the different types of poverty people experience. And really, you know, the people of Honduras, they're brilliant. They're the super intelligent people, very, very humble. Unfortunately, they are subject to a very corrupt system. And so they don't have a lot of means. But my goal would be to continue doing this until I no longer practice medicine. Once I stop practicing medicine, I can't really participate doing them anymore. Once you lose your license and you're not practicing, then unfortunately you can't practice medicine in another country. But 10 years is good though.
I see. Okay. So are you planning a big international travel experience when you FI, or what's your vision of when you see yourself and your wife retired early?
So right now I'm not FI, only because I spend way too much money. I'm kind of a fat FI. Once I reach FI, my wife and I, just to be clear, we used to spend like crazy. We were spendaholics. And I read Physician on Fire's post about the four physicians, one who basically blew all his money. The next guy saved 10%. The next guy saved 30%. The next guy saved 60%. And the guy that saved 60% was obviously able to save enough money to retire within 10 years. So that was pretty amazing. That kind of it had a huge impact on me. So what I did is I decided to cut my spending by 40 to 50%. And I did that for the first year. And now I've cut it back to about 30%, which is more comfortable. The problem is I still live kind of I think I still overspend my money. I mentioned earlier, if I just stopped spending all my money tomorrow, I could easily be FI right now and then just retire. The problem with that then is, like I said, I want to get my kids through school. Once I do achieve FI in 10 years, I want to do a 60-40 split of traveling. And then my goal is to help other physicians with financial literacy. I want to help other physicians with negotiation. I'm currently part of a mastermind with these physicians that I told you about. And our goal is to create digital products and or seminars to help physicians achieve their own financial independence, or at least achieve enough money and savings so that they could do whatever they want. They don't have to depend upon an employer. So whether I'm practicing medicine or not, I'm still going to be working pretty hard. So it's not like I'm going to just stop working and do nothing. As far as travel, I've traveled quite a bit this year. I'm going to make going to Honduras kind of an annual thing. I'll blog about it. If other people would like to join me, we'd be totally happy to have them. It'll be awesome. And then probably just continue traveling with friends that I've met along the way. You know, the beautiful thing about being a blogger, and I'm sure you've already experienced this, you meet friends all over the world, and they're really, really nice people, and they always open up their hearts and their homes to you, and you could just go visit them anytime you want.
I love that. So you mentioned that you were saving a lot more, but you recently cut back your savings rate. This is something that we were talking about in the last episode where Gwen and I were mentioning how we're easing the reins a little bit on our savings rates as well. What does that look like for you? Like, what is that? How did you come to terms with that?
Well, so my favorite thing to do is future value calculators. I love calculators. I love spreadsheets. When it comes to the numbers, I'm a math geek. And the more I played with the numbers, the more it kind of just made sense to me. So I read the one-page financial plan book. And as long as I keep monthly tabs as to whether or not I'm meeting those benchmarks, then I can feel like I can loosen the reins. So for example, with Future Value Calculator, I just did a post about this where I figured if in 10 years, if I save $135,000 with my current net worth, I'm going to be able to save like $4 million, which again, I'm sure to this audience sounds like a lot of money. But if you consider how much debt I had starting out, as long as I am saving just enough money to meet those benchmarks, then I'm fine. In fact, it has to do with your burn rate. If I really, really stop spending money altogether, I probably could retire tomorrow. But the reason why I'm loosening the reins is the money still seems to be coming in. I'm setting my goal for as far as my rate of return at 5% through the stock market, and I'm continuously hitting those benchmarks. I use William Bernstein's method of investing. So I believe in a balanced portfolio, and every time I'm doing well in one particular category, I'll rebalance my portfolio. And just using that technique, things seem to be working pretty consistently. And so within the first year of saving, I realized that I was oversaving and I was still meeting my expectations. So then I told my family that we didn't have to be so crazy. Although the one thing that I have told my wife and my family is we can spend any dollar amount so long as is whatever you buy makes you happy. I mean, when I say happy, it better mean the whole wide world to you. So we stopped all the frivolous spending and we pretty much directed our money now towards travel. So if that means visiting friends or family or going to places that we haven't seen before that enriches our kids' experience, then we're happy to invest that money in that.
Okay, two things I want to dive into. The first one, when you're talking about rebalancing, I'm assuming that a lot of people listening choose the index fund approach for most of their money, where you just put it in there and you ride the stock market and you don't really do anything active. I'm not familiar with the method that you talked about. You're talking about your after-tax brokerage account, or do you also do this within retirement accounts? And what exactly do you do? Like, what are you talking about from a different category perspective?
What I do is I set targets for all my different – so I do index funds, obviously. So I do Vanguard index funds. I also do Schwab index funds. And I do Fidelity index funds. And the only reason why I do the three different brokerage accounts is because that's where my employers were. I discovered Dollar Roller, dollarroller.com, and I found the most amazing spreadsheet on it. It's basically an investment tracking spreadsheet. And so what I do is I have my stock portfolio and my asset allocation, and I come up with targets. And so I will look at my stocks as an example, and I'll pick a target for my stocks. Then I'll pick a target for my bonds, and then I'll pick a target for my cash, and then I'll pick a target for alternatives. Now, alternatives can be like REITs or gold, silver, other types of investments, cryptocurrencies. Then I'll set the targets. As each asset class does very, very well, the other asset classes might not do as well. And so then I'll rebalance. So about every quarter to every, about every 60 to 90 days, I'll rebalance them. So if the stock market's rocking, I'll shift some of that money into my bonds and vice versa. And so the two guys that I really, really respect and I think they're amazing is William Bernstein and Rick Ferry. And so I've read both their books. I think Rick Ferry's book is all about asset allocation, and it really dives deep into why you want to have good asset allocation. And if you look at the different categories of investments, you won't have one category that will just rock every single year. And sometimes the bonds will do better. Sometimes real estate will do better. And so what I like to do is I do a really balanced approach. And so I'm always trying to set my targets. I use personal capital to keep track of all those targets. And then I rebalance as things kind of get off. So for example, Rick Ferry it's called the Rick Ferry rule. He thinks that 54% of your money should be in stocks, 27% should be in international stocks, 9% should be in alternatives, and 10% in bonds. Whereas William Bernstein's more of a 60-40 guy, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. And then if you look at those portfolios over the course of the past, 100 years, they both perform rather well. The idea being that they're going to grow in a certain rate. And for me, my target is 5%. If I can hit 5%, that's awesome. And then what I turn around is I plug that into my future value calculator. And then I kind of figure out what my targets are for the month, for the quarter, and then for the year. And so far, just using these techniques, I've been right on.
That's a really interesting approach. And I'm assuming you mean doroller.net for that spreadsheet that you mentioned?
I'm sorry, that's exactly what I meant, doroller.
Okay, cool. We will link to that in the show notes for sure. So in terms of your investment strategy, is there anything else that you do that may be unique compared to other strategies that you know are more common in the FIRE community?
Well, this is not going to be very popular in the FIRE community, but I really like cryptocurrencies. I'm kind of one of those crazy on the fringe kind of guys. I've probably watched every cryptocurrency documentary and it really vibes with me. Like I like the idea that, there is a currency out there that's not subject to manipulation by the government. So perfect example, if you look at the stock market today, right? You get a crazy tweet by our president, and then the stock market dives 4.5%. If you look at something like that, it just doesn't sit well with me. And I don't want all my money to be at risk based upon whatever a government policy has in place. And so for me, the idea that there's this international currency that nobody has control over, and it's still kind of on the fringe, and that maybe investors are starting to get into it, then maybe it might be something worthwhile to invest in. So for example, Fidelity, Amazon, a couple of other major people are starting to use cryptocurrency. And so for me, I'm kind of at least 1% of my portfolio is in cryptos right now.
And specifically what you use? Do you use Coinbase?
I use Coinbase. I use Binance. Those are the two main ones. There are a couple of others that I'm going to start dabbling in. So over the course of the past 5 years, if you look at the cryptocurrency market, I think part of the reason why it peaked and then completely dropped was the demand for access to the cryptocurrencies during the boom was in such demand that the exchanges could not keep up with it. So they end up crashing. The Coinbase crashed, Bitfinex crashed, Kraken crashed. In fact, Kraken, I had two doctor friends that were trying to get money to Kraken. And no matter how much they tried, they could not get money onto the field. And next thing you know, 5 minutes later, the thing just crashes. And so it really hurt confidence of all the investors. And so right now, all those investors that were interested in it a year ago are still really not, they're still shying away from it. Once they regain their confidence, though, I really, really believe it's going to be another kind of a thing to watch out for. So 1% of my portfolio doesn't sound like a lot. And so I feel very, very comfortable doing that. But the point is, there are so many exchanges right now that are popping up. You want to go with an exchange that you can trust. I trust Coinbase. And despite what you've read on the news, I actually do trust Binance as well.
We had someone on to discuss cryptocurrency, Erica Amatori. We'll link to that in the show notes. But she made an interesting argument that if women and people that are not in the traditional majority they don't go out of their way to get interested and started with cryptocurrency, then maybe if this is the future, they won't have access to our monetary system. It's kind of like an interesting argument.
Okay, so because by the time they get in, it'll be too late? Is that the argument?
Yeah, like the people who are shaping it right now may be the existing majority. So if you really care about this, then even if you don't care about cryptocurrency, maybe you should be interested in learning more about it.
Precisely. So what's interesting about cryptocurrency, and I still, you know, a lot of people struggle with the concept, but there's only 21 million Bitcoin as an example. There's only 21 million. There'll never be more than 21 million ever. There's how many billion people in the world right now? 7 billion? If you then were to divide all 21 million between the 7 billion, you're going to get a fraction of a fraction, maybe 1/100,000th of a Bitcoin. And so it's possible in the future, let's say that did become the global currency, even if you have 1/100,000th of it, you might still have a lot of money. Some people argue, and I don't necessarily believe this, but some people argue that just having one Bitcoin right now in your possession, you might be one of the top 0.01% in the next 10 years. So I don't know. That's what I've heard. Whether or not it's true or not, I don't know. But having one Bitcoin in my portfolio isn't going to be that drastic of a, even if I lose the whole Bitcoin or it becomes worth zero, it's not going to hurt my overall portfolio. But having it could potentially help my portfolio immensely in a year. Who knows? I mean, in 10 years.
Right. I have a huge book on cryptocurrency that I've been meaning to read, and it's just taking me forever to get through it. I understand this concept, but for some reason, it just comes across as super boring. Do you have any resources that you go to learn about this that you find interesting?
Oh my God, where do I begin? So there's a guy, his name is Crypto Zombie, and this is a YouTube channel, Crypto Gut Zombie. The other guy is FUD TV on YouTube, and the third guy is Crowns Crypto Cave. All three of these guys are brilliant in their own way. They approach it very, very differently. Some of them go over the fundamentals. Some of them go over the technical aspects of it. And then some of them go over the behind the scenes, what's happening with cryptocurrencies. All of them, though, are super intelligent. They're very young, and they know cryptocurrency inside and out. I'm not a financial advisor. I don't give financial advice. I would never recommend somebody actually buy cryptocurrencies unless they're willing to lose 100% of their investment. For me, though, I'm willing to invest 1%. I'm willing to take a chance, and I'm willing to lose it all in order to potentially take, you know, I mean, if, let's say this thing takes off, it might be like 100x return, something that crazy. What do they say? Without great risk, you won't get great reward. So taking a little bit of risk is not that big of a deal for me.
Yep. And before anyone listening is freaking out right now about cryptocurrency, I think this is the approach that I want to take on the podcast to these things. I don't want to just dismiss different ideas here. You could go down the approach to say, I don't want to hear about it. Cryptocurrency is shoe shiners. Let's just talk about index funds. But then we're not actually going to learn and grow. So we're going to continue to push the boundaries to talk about different investing philosophies on this show. And we're talking about cryptocurrency today.
Oh, yeah. I've gotten so much crap. Let me tell you, my peers, they've given me so much crap about this, whether it's my medical peers or whether it's my FI friends. It's like kryptonite to them. It's not kryptonite. They don't have anything to do with it. But for me, it's something that I enjoy reading about. I enjoy it. I think of it kind of as a hobby. And so if you just look at it from that perspective, it's easy to, you know, like I'm sure every single one of our listeners has a strange hobby that they enjoy, maybe whether it's coin collecting or something else, you know, just kind of look at it that way.
Exactly. And we're not going to be susceptible to groupthink. Even if we're hearing this and saying, you know what, this isn't for me, at least that's independent thought versus I don't even want to hear about it because blah, 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 blah.
So, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, cool. All right. So moving on from cryptocurrency, the last segment that I want to talk to you about, when you and I were chatting in the fall at FinCon, we had a conversation about salary negotiation, contract negotiation. And I forget the phrase that you used, but it was like, if you're the Tom Brady of your industry, then this is what you do. And that really appealed to me. A couple of weeks ago, we had Financial Mechanic on the podcast, and we were talking to her about salary negotiation, but it was almost from the perspective of if you're the underdog. And I have been the underdog in situations prior and was able to negotiate my salary. Now I think that I've been in my industry for a significant amount of time and also in a similar role, I would be in a different place, in a more of a place of strength. So I'm curious to hear all of your best tips on this.
I think I've been a decent negotiator my whole career. And even when I first left residency, I was able to negotiate a signing bonus and whatever terms I wanted early on. So I was a resident. I was in my third year of residency. I found a job and they offered a signing bonus. And it was like April and the job didn't start till July. And I said, well, I appreciate the signing bonus and I appreciate, you know, the terms of the contract, but I want the signing bonus right now. I'm broke. I don't have any money. I'm in debt. And they agreed almost immediately. And my other peers, I had found out later, were also offered a signing bonus, less money, but they actually had to wait for a period of time before they even received it. So they had to work for 6 months before they received it. And so I thought that was very odd. At the end of the day, we both got, you know, the similar amount of money. We both got the signing bonus, except for I got it when I asked for it, and they didn't get it until much, much later. And I think the difference between getting it and not getting it is really recognizing your value, what your worth is, and then not being afraid to ask in a way that's not offensive and in a way to kind of let your employer know that not only are you going to help the organization, but that you're going to impact the entire system. The way I look at it now, I wrote that article, Are You the Tom Brady of Medicine? And the idea is if you are the best of the best in medicine, when you graduate from your residency, there's really no way for the employer to differentiate you from your peers. Now, they don't typically look at your test scores. They basically really rely heavily on your letters of recommendation from your medical director, and they basically look at from the school that you come from. So for example, if you come from a top-end school, it's going to carry a lot more weight than if you're coming from a lower-tier school. Typically, those people will command slightly higher salary, but here's the problem. Medical jobs are highly regulated by the law, okay? There's something called the Stark Law. Stark Law first started in around 1998, and the whole purpose of the Stark Law was to prevent physicians from self-referring. So in other words, let's say you're a physician and you owned your own surgery center, or you owned your own radiology center, or you owned your own pharmacy. You're not allowed to refer to yourself because what they found was that physicians would then unnecessarily prescribe x-rays and drugs and all these things to kind of scalp and or to line their pocket. And so they passed a law saying that physicians are no longer to do that. It's also called the anti-kickback law. So typically, if you look at medicine, the way you make medicine as a hospital is you need somebody to do procedures for you. Procedures typically command the highest reimbursement. So if you come into a hospital and you're about to have open heart surgery, the hospital's going to be able to make a lot more money off something like that than, say, somebody who comes in with a runny nose. So diametrically completely different. The same amount of time is expended, but you're going to make 10x or 100x on the open heart surgery versus the runny nose. And so what hospitals found prior to 1989, they would entice surgeons to work at the hospital by potentially giving them uncompensated or unearned compensation. So for example, they'd give them $100,000 just for showing up at the hospital. That is now illegal. You cannot do that anymore. So if you want to work for a hospital, you have to demonstrate that you actually did some work for them. Likewise, let's say you're the best surgeon on the planet and also the fastest. If at some point you exceed what the government says is the max amount of money that you could earn, then you could be subject to fine. The physician could be subject to fine, and also the hospital could be subject to fine. So what's interesting, though, physicians then basically come into medicine with a huge disadvantage because they have this law kind of over their head. And at the same time, they've been residents their whole life. Being a resident physician means you work under a group of other attending physicians and you don't make any money at all. You have no authority. You're not independent and you really can't even practice independently until you graduate, you pass your boards and you're given license. So psychologically, physicians, generally speaking, feel subservient to their peers. And then when we're talking about their senior peers, and they feel subservient to the system because they've been told time and time again that they're subject to all these different laws. So what happens is most physicians, when they go out, let's say they graduate from Harvard or Yale or whatever, you know, Ivy League school, the first job they go and they get, they may not even negotiate their contract. And I can't tell you how many physicians I've met over the years who basically on their first interview, they basically have chosen the location and they say, nope, whatever you give me is what I'll take. And it just blows my mind that they do that, because what it does is it brings the entire system and everybody's compensation down. Personally, I'm a member of a medical group management associates. It's called MGMA. It's an organization that collects physician salaries. So they aggregate all the physician salaries and they determine a mean and then a percentile of each physician salary. They'll come with the 10th percentile, the 25th percentile, the 75th percentile and 95th percentile. And when physicians don't negotiate, what ends up happening is each year that data is aggregated. And if physicians don't negotiate, then each year as they put the data together, the net effect is all physician salaries go down. And so if physicians don't negotiate, everybody's salaries go down. If you're the Tom Brady of medicine, you're obligated. You have to at least have the understanding that you need to negotiate your contract and shoot for the 75th or 95th percentile. What most physicians do, though, they're happy to take the 25th percentile or the mean. And I know this sounds a bit complicated, but the bottom line is you have to know your industry, you have to know what your market value is, and you have to have the data to back you up when you go to the negotiation table. Now, that's just part of it. You also have to have the emotional intelligence. You have to have the actual negotiation skills to then communicate with the person across from you. Now, typically when you negotiate with a hospital, you're negotiating with a professional negotiator, somebody who's been doing this their entire life. And behind them, they have an army of lawyers, right? So they know exactly what the data is. They know exactly where they want you to come in so they can maximize their profit. And so if you are the Tom Brady of medicine, you have an obligation to get educated to become the best possible negotiator. And one of my goals as a physician blogger and podcaster is I want to help people learn how to gain these negotiation skills so that not only they help themselves, they help the whole industry.
How do you know if you're Tom? How do you know you're not just another run-of-the-mill quarterback and not the greatest of all time?
It's a funny thing you say that. So if you look at the data, all you got to do is kind of go to the data. Not all residencies are equal in their terms of competition, okay? So if you look at some residencies are relatively easy to get into, whereas other residencies are extremely competitive, okay? Like you have maybe a 1 in 1,000 chance of getting certain residencies because, you know, if you're not the top of the top, 1% of your class, AOA, come from a very, you know, prestigious institution, the odds of you even getting that are pretty, pretty low. Now, the funny thing is the Tom Brady's, typically speaking, the top 1% of physicians, they're a funny bunch. They're so smart and they're so surrounded with other smart people that they typically go into academics and they typically go into research. And so the irony is the smartest of the smart people typically settle for the least salary because they're more interested in getting published. They're more interested in making a name for themselves. And there's a lot of prestige in that, but it doesn't necessarily help them financially. And, you know, the rest of us who are not the top of the top, we still have a huge advantage, though, because guess what? There's a massive shortage of physicians right now. Becoming a physician is very hard. And so even if you're at the bottom of the class, last person to graduate, you still have a huge edge. And even if you're at the bottom, you still have to take advantage of the fact that you can't belittle what you've accomplished. You've accomplished a ton.
Okay, got it. And by the way, we keep mentioning Tom Brady. If we're giving someone like PTSD, I'm very sorry. I'm from Boston, so I love saying his name, but everyone else, you know, I'm sure they're dying right now.
A funny story. I actually met the real Tom Brady, who's another anesthesiologist. Hopefully he hears this. And it was the funniest thing. I wrote this article, and then I meet the very next week, I meet a Tom Brady anesthesiologist. It was so funny. And I said, I just wrote an article about you. So it's Tom Brady, the anesthesiologist, not the football player, I assure you.
Oh, okay. Okay. Got it. So can you give us maybe one or two actionable tips? How, when you're in the negotiation, we talked about like getting yourself psyched up to do it. It sounds like the answer is you just have to do it. If you don't do it, you're bringing down the whole average of the whole group. Like it's a bigger issue than just you. Just do it.
Absolutely.
And we talked about make sure that you're not offending the other person and you're being a pleasant person to negotiate with, but at the same time, you're being firm. What does that look like in actionable steps or language?
Great. So I've done a lot of research on this and I've negotiated 3 personal contracts for my entire group plus my own contract. And I've realized all the mistakes I made along the way. The biggest mistake I made is if you negotiate too firmly and you end up with a winner and a loser, the loser will never forgive you. And when I say never, I mean they may even seek out revenge on you. And so to be a hard bargainer, you'll always lose in the end because you may get what you want in the short term, but in the long term, you're going to lose. So the person I follow for this is Stuart Diamond, and his book's called Getting More. This guy's brilliant. I believe he's a Harvard professor, and he talks about this, and he puts his money where his mouth is. He's actually negotiated really high-end deals. I think when the last Guild Writers strike in Hollywood, he was pinnacle in getting that negotiation through. And I typically follow him now. So he says that the first, if you break down negotiation, it breaks down into 3 components. The first component is substance. And that's kind of like what you and I have been talking about. Like, what does the data say? How much is the average salary for an anesthesiologist versus a surgeon versus whatever? And what percentile rank is that? So the step one is to know where you are in terms of your competitiveness. What range of dollar value are you worth? Those are the facts and the figures. And then what do you bring to the table? Are you the Tom Brady, or do you just have average skills? So you kind of need to know what your net worth is, and you have to be able to articulate how much value you bring to your institution. But that's only 10%. And what Stuart says is that really the chunk of it, the bulk of it, is a conversation with another human being. Number one, 50%, is of whether people like you or not. So if you go into negotiation, and I've done this too, you go into negotiation and you come out with a hard stance right from the beginning, you might put the person off the wrong way. And so he always talks about like what pictures are going on in these people's heads. So when you look at, when you're opposite somebody, you need to say to yourself, okay, emotionally, what state are they in? Did they just, you know, what are they thinking? Can I put myself in their shoes? And then can I get them to like me? Because at the end, that's really what you want. The other person has to like you in order to have a successful negotiation. The third component is really the emotions involved in the negotiation. When we first started negotiation, you kind of mentioned this, that, you know, people kind of clam up and they get afraid. Acknowledge that. Just be open to the fact that you're going to have emotions. Deal with your emotions. If your heart is pumping, you know, you can say that, you know, I'm a little nervous right now. That will break the ice. It'll make people feel more at ease. And then as you go through the process, you're going to play a game back and forth. Emotionally speaking, hey, I want to commit to you. Are you willing to commit to me? He really thinks this is the guts of negotiation. And I use it all the time. I use it with my family. I use it with my patients, because I have to negotiate with my patients every day to convince them that I'm going to take care of them and that they're going to be safe. And so I always try to get a human connection with them. That's the first thing. I rarely focus on the drugs that I'm giving them. I don't ever go into the technical aspects unless they ask for the technical aspects. And I really try to create a connection with them. And that seems to work more than anything else.
Those are excellent tips. And it's an update from everyone who was listening from last week. I'm currently in the middle, I wouldn't call it a negotiation, but I have not announced my pregnancy at work until I get a raise for taking my new management position and the new title, and it still has not come through yet.
Oh, that's awesome. And you know, that's it. Seth Godin, I love Seth. The guy, I mean, he's so consistent and his material is so awesome. His latest book was called Lynchpin, I believe. What made my negotiation so successful and I was able to go part-time was that I made myself integral in this organization. I attended every meeting. I was the go-to person when problems came up. And if you are that person, you've just made yourself the Tom Brady. You show up to an organization, you are invaluable. And then when you go to the negotiation table, it's that much easier. Say, hey, here's what I bring to the table. Here's how I'm going to grow and make the organization even better. And here's why I deserve the raise. And quite frankly, if you've already demonstrated that, they know if you go to another organization, you're going to do that for them as well. So when I quit my job, the other hospital that I was negotiating with, they knew of my reputation. They knew that I ran the department. They knew of my accomplishments. And so they were more willing to give me the salary I commanded. So that made my organization more willing to negotiate. And it worked out great.
I know you have a bunch of articles on this on your site. Do you have any in particular that you want to plug and we'll put in the show notes?
You know what? Just if you go to docofalltrades.com and on the menu it says negotiations, just click on that and it'll bring everything up. I'm going to make a resources page for everybody. I haven't done this yet. But I've probably read about, I don't know, 10 or 15 books on the subject, and they're all fantastic, and I recommend all of them. The more you read about this is great, so knowledge is great, but wisdom comes from practice. And so one thing that I recommend for people is next time you go to the supermarket or you go shopping or anywhere you go, just start negotiating with people. The more you practice outside of your work environment, the more successful you'll be when you have a very serious negotiation.
Good to know. Great. All right, Jesse, so we're going to close it out with the final two. The first question, if people want to learn more about you, where can they find you?
So I'm all over the place. The easiest way to find me would be docofalltrades.com. The second place to find me is my podcast, which is thephysiciannegotiator.com. And I'm also in the process of developing a new website called unpluggedparents.com. And I'm kind of learning how to develop niche websites. My physician friends have told me that this is really something that they're interested in and they want to learn how to develop that. So I'm going to start processing and learning how to teaching people how to build niche websites. So unpluggedparents.com is my newest one.
And Unplugged Parents, you're saying that this is for parents that want to start their own website?
Unpluggedparents.com is for parents who basically are they want to get their kids off the screens and then see what happens. On my Doc of All Trades website, I'm going to be talking about how to make niche websites, and I'm going to show people how you can start a niche website from start to finish. And Unplugged Parents is my experiment website that I'm creating right now.
Ah, I see. Okay, cool. So you're doing like a test experiment as you're going through the process. Got it.
Exactly.
Cool. All right. Awesome. And I know you said that you're expanding. You're not just for physicians. You want to welcome anyone who wants to come in, particularly people who are in health professions.
Exactly. So if you look at physicians and all healthcare professionals, we all are subject to the same laws, rules, and regulations. So, for example, the MGMA also has data on nurse practitioners, medical assistants, physician's assistants, even technicians. So I have all that data. I know how to negotiate on their behalf as well. So this information translates perfectly for them. Even pharmacists, it all translates, and it will help them with their careers as well.
Cool. Awesome. Great. And our final question, Jesse, what is your wildest dream?
Oh my God. If you would ask me that 3 days ago, I would say it would be to be done with medicine yesterday, but I had a good week. My wildest dream is to be completely retired in 10 years, age 53.
Isn't that funny how when you have a bad day, but you've learned about financial independence, you're suddenly like, oh, I want to retire early.
Exactly. Well, it's crazy because people, you know, that's the other thing. If you are in a miserable job, my God, get out of that job and find a better job. I think that's the biggest thing I've seen people struggle with is if you're miserable, there are much better places out there. You know, time is the most precious asset that we have. There's no reason to be miserable in your job. Just get a different one.
Yeah, I guess I would say if that is a thought that you have every single day and you have the ability to get out, then you should get out. But there's nothing you can do can be perfect. Like I could get in this mood when I'm going to the post office because, you know, something happened to me. It's not always related to my job.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Not always.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you so much, Jay.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Go to our website, firedrillpodcast.com, to continue the discussion and get the link to our private Facebook group.
If you like us, leave us a review on iTunes. If you're like me, you have no idea how to do that. So in the podcast app or in iTunes, search for Fire Drill Podcast, find it, click the reviews tab, and write something to make my mother proud of me. We read every single review and want to say thank you from the bottom of our hearts for making this podcast possible.